I'm Haley Stone, and this is the story behind my stories.
You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret White, Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanders,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Haley Stone.
Hey guys, we're back today with a brand new author interview with author Haley Stone. She has a fantastic new book that I know you guys are going to love. I am a huge fan. I'm calling it my book of the year. And this interview is a great interview, but we had a death in the family this past week, and I was away from my normal studio setup, and so I recorded this interview over Skype on my phone in my car. So Haley's side of the audio sounds pretty good, and mine, I'm using just kind of a basic set of headphones, so please forgive the audio quality on this one. I've done some editing. Hopefully it's not too distracting, but the interview is completely worth it. So thank you for all the well wishes that we got on social media and the phone calls and text. Thank you guys for all of that. Now we're going to talk about some sponsors and then get right into our show with Haley Stone. Author Mary Buckham has a 3-book set. She's a USA Today bestseller. The Invisible Recruits, The Beginning, a 3-book set. Kindle edition is on sale now for $2.99. That's 3 books for $2.99. Join new IR agents Alec Nosiak and Kelly McAllister as they struggle to master their newfound preternatural abilities while being thrown into a dark world of danger and intrigue. Being an invisible recruit means learn hard lessons fast or die trying. Hidden from a world unaware of magic, Alex and Kelly are members of a group of operatives known as the Invisible Recruits, the only ones willing to stand between mankind and those powerful preternatural factions, seeking to change the balance of power and gain world domination. While battling for their lives, Alex and Kelly both must deal with dangerous creatures, mysterious paths, shape-shifting brothers, and more. What could possibly go wrong? Begin with the novella that started it all, Invisible Prison, to discover how Alex Nosiak first met the IR team. Then join Alex on her initial solo mission in Invisible Magic. Next, it's time to join teammate Kelly McAllister in a race to uncover secrets and stop evil growing in the heart of Africa. Mary writes stories full of grit and determination with plenty of action, but always with a sense of hope and a good dollop of romance. Get the 3-book set for only $2.99, Invisible Recruits, The Beginning. A 3-book set for Kindle. Also, I'd like to thank George Kramer. His new book, To Some, It's Just a Rose, is out now. Nancy Hemingway is a beautiful, wealthy heiress that has a penchant for attracting weirdos. When roses start mysteriously appearing at her doorstep, at work, and everywhere, she turns. Her friends begin disappearing. Nancy enlists her eccentric cousin Etna to help her figure out what's going on, only to discover that Etna isn't who she thought she was. Nothing is as it appears to be, and someone is targeting Nancy. Can she outsmart this lunatic and find her friends before it's too late? The new psychological thriller from George Kramer, To Some, It's Just a Rose. Thank you to J.R. Hanley and Chris Winder. Their new book, Breach Team, is out now. Survival means fighting through the unknown. Corporal John Hardin is a decorated soldier living in the shadow of his father, a celebrated war hero. Determined to make his own way in the galaxy, John develops a reputation as a brawler serving aboard the USS Hughes. A rescue beacon brings John and his fellow legionnaires to a cargo ship thought lost 2 decades ago, and the heavily damaged alien vessel of an unknown species that took it down. With the brass demanding details and apparent survivors begging for aid, John's team boards the derelict ships, vowing to leave no man behind. On board, nightmares become reality as John and his team are separated and left behind, presumed to be killed in action. Assaulted on all sides by mysterious alien tech, John gets the chance to finally prove himself worth being his father's son, if he can survive the onslaught. The way home is inside, and John won't back down from the fight, though a determined enemy will make him pay for every inch. Breach Team is a non-stop action thrill ride with fast-paced warfare written by 2 veterans. Join the fight by getting your copy today. Breach Team by J.R. Handley and Chris Winder.
Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am super excited to have Haley Stone on the show with me today. Haley has a fantastic new book that everyone is raving about, including me. It's this is going to be my book of the year. I think it is. It is so good, y'all. It is. It's such an amazing book. It's called Make Me No Grave, and it's a weird Western, which I was super excited to see. Haven't seen many great Westerns lately, but you guys have to get this book. Welcome to the show, Haley.
Thanks, Hank. I'm really excited to be on it.
Well, thanks, and I'm sorry for just gushing about your book, but it's just amazing. I can't. I can't tell you how much I'm enjoying it.
It really means a lot to me to hear.
Thank you. Before we get into all the good stuff we've got to talk about, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Ooh, wow. Well, I've always wanted to be a writer, so... Probably my earliest memory would be as soon as I could write, I was putting words together and making my own little short stories. There was a computer program back on a really old Windows called Paint, Write, and Play. And you could write little words and you could add little clip art and kind of form a story. And I'd say that's probably where I started out, just making those stories and then, you know, running to my mom, hey, look at this story. And she was always very encouraging.
Were you a big reader as a kid?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Love to read. My dad also would read me stories before I could read myself. And, I started to predict how the stories would end, and I was like, no, you've read that one before. And so he ended up making up stories to satisfy my interests.
Oh, I love that. What kinds of stories did you like the most?
Ooh. Probably action, adventure. I do recall at one point when I was just starting out as a writer, that I was writing Johnny Quest fan fiction back in the first or second grade. And I thought it was the greatest thing. So probably that sort of thing.
That's amazing. So will we be seeing a Johnny Quest anthology from you anytime soon?
Hey, if... if you want to get into contact with me, I'm always down to do a tie-in.
There you go. Oh, man. So at what point, from playing on the computer and making your own stories and putting those together, did it ever occur to you that, hey, this is something that I could do, on a big scale, like on a professional scale? At what point did that kind of switch go off for you?
I always felt like I was going to be a writer. That was always my goal, and I kind of headed towards it single-mindedly. Right. So I don't really remember a point exactly where it was like, I am going to become a writer, because it kind of has always been there for me, that passion and the drive.
I know you, your parents were big supporters and motivators for you, with your mom, the encouragement, and your dad telling you stories. Was there ever like a teacher in school or anyone that kind of recognized that storyteller gene in you and gave you encouragement?
In school, not so much. The schools that I attended were very much oriented towards math and science, and English was strictly essay writing and that sort of thing. So I didn't really get to explore creative writing as much in school as I did just on my own. But I did have a group of friends that I wrote with for many years, writing collaborative stories that were Star Wars fan fiction, as it turned out. I come from a fan fiction background. and And they always encouraged me, and I learned a lot from them as well. So they were older than I was, so I kind of, my dad has a saying, to become better, you play someone better than you. And it's kind of the same way with writing. Like, I wrote with people who were better writers than me at the time, and I improved my own craft that way.
I like that. I like that a lot. When did you finish your first? Well, first off, before we get that, you also write poetry. What is your fascination with poetry?
Oh, poetry actually came more recently to me. I never wrote poetry until about in 2014. I took a creative writing class at a college, and my professor was Joshua McKinney, who is a poet himself. And part of the class was learning how to write poetry. And so I did that thinking, like, I'm not going to be any good at this. Like, I am strictly, you know, creative writing, stories, novels, that sort of thing. But I fell in love with it. And you mentioned before if a teacher ever encouraged me. I guess I would say Professor McKinney did, because he took one look at my first poem, and there was this long pause, and then he said, "How long have you been writing poetry?" And I was like, "Oh, this is my first." And he was just blown away. And I was like, "Great, awesome, that's encouraging."
Oh, that's so funny. You know, most people that I talk to, me included, you know, kind of went through a teenage or in young adult kind of angsty phase where you write really bad poetry, and then, you know, and there's a difference between writing bad poetry and being a poet. But you know, a lot of people go through that phase and then go, you know what, I think writing fiction is a lot easier than this. And you know, I can at least take my time and make something decent.
Out of something long form. I did the reverse entirely.
That's so funny. That's so funny. That you just never went through that angsty phase of writing.
I wouldn't say that. But all of my angsty stuff was like hurt comfort fan fiction for Star Wars and Lord of the Rings and that sort of thing.
Nice. What is it? Do you know what clicks for you when writing poetry? What makes it so, I won't say easy for you, because just because you do well at something doesn't mean it's easy. But is there a different mechanism for you when you're writing poetry than when you write long form?
There is a visceral feeling that I tend to dive at when it comes to a poem. My poetry tends to be a little bit more angry, I guess you might say. I'm driving towards a certain emotion that I want to come across, and without naming the emotion. So I want to invoke it without, you know, beating you over the head and saying, like, this is a poem about sadness, or, you know, what have you. and it's very much a gut level thing. And I mean, writing in general tends to be that way for me. Sometimes you just write a line, it'll come to you, and then you just write it down. And sometimes that's the only line that comes to you for a while. And then later you can come back and you read that line over, and suddenly you know how the rest of the poem is going to go.
Right. You mentioned writing fan fiction a few times, and a lot of it being science fiction and fantasy. Do you remember what book it was that turned you on to science fiction and fantasy, or has it always just been the thing that you love?
Ooh, good question. I've always loved it. I would say, there were probably books earlier than this, but the books that I found very formative was it was a book series called The Jedi Apprentice series by Jude Watson. And it was about a young Obi-Wan Kenobi being trained by Qui-Gon Jinn. And I received two of the series on Easter from my parents one year. And they were like book 6 or 7. So I had no idea what was going on, but I was like, I know Obi-Wan. So I kind of just stuck with it, then went back and read the previous books. And that's still, to me, one of my favorite book series.
I love it so much. There was something fantastic about all of the, especially the expanded universe books, the Star Wars books, because we had these characters that we were all familiar with, and you have this kind of glancing knowledge of them, and then you get these books where you just go so deep, and the universe is so huge, and I think it really just opens up the imagination when you've got a universe that big and these characters, and knowing that stories can just keep going on and on and on.
Absolutely. It kind of fleshes out more of the Star Wars universe, and it does feel like a universe living and breathing with all sorts of people in it. Yeah, I love the expanded universe quite a bit.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the first novel that you wrote and completed. I know that you've had a science fiction series published by Random House. Was that the first book that you completed, or was that just the first one that you sold?
That was the first one that I sold. The first one that I completed, I wrote for NaNoWriMo, National Novel Writing Month. And it was a YA zombie novel called Drop Dead. And I had never written horror before. I had never written zombies before. I just kind of dove into it. And that was the first novel I actually finished. I'd done NaNoWriMo and won a couple of years before that, but I'd never actually finished the book. It was like hitting 50,000 words and then being, great, done. I'm never going to look at this again. But that was the first one that I finished. And then after that, I wrote Machinations. And Machinations for me was, and I wrote that outside of NaNoWriMo because I wanted to prove to myself that I could finish a novel without the handholding of NaNoWriMo, then the like extreme deadline pressure. I just wanted to see if I could do it myself.
There's a certain camaraderie that comes with NaNoWriMo.
Definitely.
If you get on social media, you know, all of your friends, you get updates every day, and you know, I got my word count for today, or you know, if you didn't get your word count, you start seeing that other people have, and it's kind of a little chastisement, a little
totally.
Bit.
I'm hyper competitive. I used to do with one of my friends, and we would just go back and forth with our word counts. And even though I was like, oh, I'm done for the day, I'd see like they had their word count up again, and I was like, oh, darn it, I gotta keep going.
So much fun. And there's something about just getting to that 50,000 words, and whether you ever do anything with that story or not, I don't know, for a lot of people I've talked to, just that exercise of doing it raises your confidence, but it also does something for for your ability to tell a story. I think a lot of the problems that we come up against sometimes is just confidence, just believing in the story. And NaNo teaches you to just stop worrying about that, just get words out, and then have something to edit at the end. And I think it's such a fantastic thing that I highly encourage everybody to do it if they get a chance.
Oh, absolutely. And I try it every year, and I haven't been successful in recent years because I've leaned a little bit too far into perfectionism with my writing. So I end up getting stuck and I fall behind. But my feeling is, hey, if you write 50,000 words in a month, fantastic. If you write 500 words in a month, great. Those were 500 words you didn't have at the beginning of the month.
That's right. So tell me about Machinations. What is that story about, and how did that come to be published?
So Machinations is a story about the clone of a resistance icon during it's post-apocalyptic. So after machines have wiped out most of humanity and taken over, there's a resistance icon. She is the face of the resistance. Everyone knows who she is. And she dies in the first chapter, but she's made plans to have her clone take over in her stead because humanity doesn't need another martyr. They need a leader. Unfortunately, that clone does not have all of the memories or abilities of her predecessor, but she still is required to step into that role. And not everyone knew about this plan. So she meets resistance from her predecessor's lover, who she still has feelings for as well, and people who are skeptical about whether she can lead as well. And amidst all of this, you know, emotional and identity crisis drama, you have the machines who want to find this last hidden base in Alaska and just murder everyone there.
Wasn't there a follow-up to that book as well, Counterpart?
Yes. Counterpart takes place not long after the conclusion of Machinations, and it continues Rona's story. Rona's the main character as she navigates leading the resistance and kind of beginning to unite the separate factions of humanity that are out there. They learn, like, there are more people out there, and they're trying to get humanity united so that they can actually start to take back the planet from the machines.
What's a really cool concept to start by killing your main character and then, you know, have a clone. As the writer of that story, what did that afford you to have that character, you know, immediately kind of put her will out there, but then have it taken over by someone else? Did that kind of open up the possibilities of, you know, when you're talking post-apocalyptic stories, we've read and seen, you know, so many, and a lot of them tend to go kind of the same path. But you throw us a twist right at the beginning. What did that afford you as the writer to separate from the pack?
Well, it's kind of interesting because the book began, I just had a single line in my head. After I'm killed, I wake up in a metal womb. And I loved the line, and I just kind of wanted to explore what was going on. So I was essentially free writing at that point, and I had no idea that it was going to be, you know, a robot apocalypse. I had none of that. I just wrote, and suddenly they were being attacked by machines. And it was like, oh, okay, that's the story we're writing. And it was only actually years later that I went back and added the first chapter where we see the original Rona as she is killed. And we see her relationship briefly to another character, Camus, her lover. So that it kind of gives you the sense of the before sense. So then when you do follow Rona, the clone, throughout the book, you see, you have that sense of history that she is trying to get back.
Gotcha. That book, those books were published by Random House Hydra, weren't they?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. How did you get that book published?
Just a traditional route. I cold queried an agent, my first agent, and then she reached out to my editor, Ann Grohl, at Random House, and went through acquisitions and all that sort of thing. And there was a point where it seemed like we might be going with Del Rey, and then they decided to decided to go with Hydra instead. And so that was a really interesting experience, and being my first time being published and working with Ann Grohl, who is amazing. So it was fun.
Nice. So the new book that is out everywhere now and everyone is raving about is called Make Me No Grave. And this is a massive departure from the robot army apocalypse story. Have you been a fan of Westerns like this? I know it's a stupid question, but this book reads with all the authenticity of any Western I've ever experienced.
Thank you.
Down to the gritty details. When did you start to love Westerns?
So this is where I expose myself and my lack of watching Westerns. I actually started enjoying Westerns after playing the first Red Dead Redemption game. Okay. That was really what sparked my love of Westerns, because there's a lot of humor in that game. that is just born naturally out of the setting. And that kind of changed my perspective on Westerns. Before that, I just kind of thought they were something my grandpa watched and right. wasn't really for me. And then from following that, I started watching like every Western thing I could think of, including Deadwood was a big one, Hell on Wheels, those. And watching those were really so I could start to get the feeling for the colloquialisms and the slang and that sort of thing.
Well, you absolutely nailed it.
Thank you.
It's incredible. You know, I was talking with Steve Bollier one day and he says, "Have you read this book?" And I said, "Not yet." He's like, "You need to stop what you're doing and read it now." and I got the audio, and the audio is just transformative. I mean, you are taken to another place.
Oliver Wyman did an incredible job.
Yes.
When I first heard it, I was blown away. It was like listening to my character come to life. It was incredible.
So cool. when I it's a weird Western. It's a fantasy Western. If you can use that term, it's a little misleading. I think.
Yeah. And that's kind of the problem that I faced with it, because it has magic, but it's not overwhelming.
No, it's not that. It's so subtle. And you are, I'm trying to remember, you're several chapters in before any magic happens, and it's so subtle. What was the idea that got this going for you?
So I actually had the idea for someone who can take other people's injuries on with a touch and kind of transfer them around, which is what one of the characters can do in the story. Almina Guillory can do that. And originally it was going to be a completely second world fantasy about a woman who serves the king as like his protector. And that's part of her job, is to make sure he doesn't get hurt and that sort of thing. And I could never really make that story work. And so then one day I had the idea of setting it in a totally different setting, and that ended up working much better.
Let's talk about the characters. There are really two main characters that we encounter in the beginning of the book. We've got Apostle Richardson and Almina Guillory. Where did Apostle come from?
Oh, Apostle, he came from, I was watching a lot of Justified at the time. Okay. And Raylan Givens, I really loved the character, his sort of forthrightness, but kind of also not lazy, but relaxed kind of manner for someone who was, you know, a U.S. Marshal. I just thought it was an interesting contradiction. And so Apostle is inspired a lot by that character. But I also wanted to explore someone who was fundamentally good at heart, put into various circumstances that really test his morality and his ethics.
He is such a unique character, and you tell the story from his point of view, and his voice is so spot on. How long did it take you to get kind of in Apostle's head, or did the story just kind of begin from his point of view?
Yeah, so I feel like I have to give a little bit of backstory to how I started the story to answer that question, which was the story originated from a one-page creative writing assignment back in college. The assignment was to write a scene between several characters featuring a specific emotion without naming it. And the emotion I was going for was anxiety. And you see that in that first scene with Almina. She's very anxious. And Apostle he basically sprang fully formed onto the page. His voice, everything. It came immediately. And I've been writing long enough to know, like, when that happens, that little spark, you just, you go for it. You follow it wherever it leads you.
Right. You talk a lot about discovering a story, and you talked about free writing earlier. Is that kind of your process, that you get an idea and you just kind of start writing to see where the characters take you?
Yeah, I've always been a discovery writer, or they sometimes call it a pantser, right by the seat of your pants. And that's, I kind of like to let the characters lead me, although in more recent years, I have started to plot and outline a little bit in advance, especially for follow-up novels and that sort of thing, because you kind of want to make sure it's a continuation in a way that is honest to the first one, but also different. Gotcha. And deadlines sometimes change the dynamic of that too, because you don't want to write, 30,000 words into a story only to discover you've started in the wrong place, or you have to cut all of those words and do something completely different with a different character, that sort of thing, which has happened to me as well.
Well, yeah, it's happened to a lot of people. Or you get 30,000 words into it and you just don't care about these characters anymore. There's not enough that's substance to them in the beginning. Yeah. So just in a real practical sense, as a pantser, how do you prevent that from happening? How do you stay the course and keep the story unfolding when you're discovering it as it goes?
Partially, I try to hold the story all in my head, which sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. I also like to use narrative goalposts are essentially what they are, where I know I'm working towards the next big scene. I know how this scene is kind of going to end, and I know I have to get from point A to point B to point C. A lot can happen in between those points, but those are kind of the pillars that are holding up the story, that I know something big is going to happen here. With Make Me No Grave, though, I kind of just made that one up as I went along, because the two characters were so compelling and the setting, I just love the Old West so much that whenever I would come across research that had something interesting, I'm like, oh, I'm going to put that in there somewhere. So that one was even more discovery writing than normal. And it took me a long time to get the ending right. As a result, there were times where I would just set the manuscript aside for months, because I couldn't figure out how to end it. And I tend to write towards the ending, not knowing it. I'll know it when I hit it, sort of thing.
Right. We talked a little while ago about the magic in the book and the fantasy elements. It is so subtle that it doesn't pull you out of the setting, which is a real skill, because when you're so deep and in the kind of visceral feeling of the Old West and the heat and the grime and the attitudes of the characters, and then you introduce someone who is so far removed from that yet completely grounded. When did the idea come to you that this was going to be a magic story of sorts? And where did Guillory come from? Did she just pop into the story as you were writing?
Yeah, Almina, yeah, she popped into the story about the same time that Apostle did. And I'm trying to think now what inspired her. And I think it was, I wanted to write kind of an angry, bitter woman. just because, I mean, that's kind of how I was feeling at the time, you know how college is. Yeah. And then writing Apostle, someone who is her complete foil, but someone who can still have compassion towards her and understanding towards what she's been through, what she's going through, and what she's struggling with. And with regards to the magic, I always knew that she could do it. It was interesting figuring out when the right time for her to use it is. And something that I think some readers, if they go back and they reread the book, they'll catch it in the scene where she is where they tried to hang her in the beginning, the right. lynch mob with the sheriff. She does use her power in that scene, but it's very subtle, and you wouldn't know what was happening unless you had that knowledge later.
Yeah, you don't realize it until Apostle starts kind of flashing back, and yep. and you're like, oh, that's what happened. But it's so subtle. Like, was that something that you had to work with in the writing to keep the subtlety there? Because I would think, you know, when you're writing a big fantasy book, you know, you want to bring out, you know, wizards and spells and stuff quickly. Yeah. And just, you know, just throw it all, you know, out there on the page. When you're writing pure fantasy, but this is obviously not pure fantasy in that sense. So was that something that you were conscious of to keep dialing it back and keep everything kind of flowing just under the surface?
I actually worried that I was being too subtle at times, and that readers would come in and they would be like, there's not enough magic in this. That, you know, like, where are all the witches and the, you know, warlocks and things? Why aren't they having big old magical fights and that sort of thing? And I went back and forth. There was a one point where I thought, maybe to make this more marketable, I just have to take the magic out entirely. But I just couldn't do it. I just felt like it was not being honest to the story that I was trying to tell. And I did get pushback from, you know, publishers that we tried to submit the book to. It kind of fell in between genres. It wasn't a complete Western because it had the magic, and it wasn't weird enough. It wasn't a Western fantasy because it didn't have enough fantasy elements. And I thought, well, maybe I'll have to add a lot more fantasy to it. But again, I just didn't feel like that was right. I've spoken about this before on Twitter about how sometimes you just have to write the story that makes you happy and the story that you believe in. And that was kind of how I felt with Make Me No Grave. It was sort of, well, maybe this won't get published, but this was the story that it meant, you know, that I intended it to be.
Well, thank God it fell between genres, because, you know, the book would not be what it is if you were pandering to one genre or another.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So, but the book did eventually find a home with Aethon Books. What was that that process like for you, and how's the book launch going?
Yeah. So I was friends with the founders of Aethon, Rhett and Steve, and they are amazing. And the launch has been amazing. Finding someone who loved the story as much as I did and understood what I was trying to do with it, there aren't words for that feeling, because yeah. I had basically given up and shelved this book. I thought, okay, it had a nice run. We tried. I'm just going to have to write the next thing, which is sometimes what you have to do. And then they loved it. And it was weird to hear people, and I mean, it still is when I see the reviews, it's just, and people love it. And it's such a great feeling, because this was like the book of my heart. It has everything that I love in a story, and it's resonating with people, which is what any writer really wants. And they support the book. I mean, they are an amazing publisher. That's my personal experience with them so far. They, you know, marketed it. They had strategies for how to target the right audience for it. And they negotiated the deal with Audible, managed to get Oliver Wyman. It was just, like, from beginning to end, it has been a great experience. And I know, like, in my past experience with publishing and that sort of thing, sometimes you have there's a lack of control for authors. And right. with Aethon, there's much more communication, which is really nice. As someone who likes to know what's going on, I really appreciate that.
That's fantastic. And Rhett and Steve are such great guys. Like you said, that this was a book, the book of your heart, you called it, and a story that you absolutely loved. And my experience has been when something resonates so deeply with the writer, There's an audience out there that it's not a singular thing that I've seen. When a story is so powerful that it moves the writer that much, that there are readers out there that will have the same experience. And we complain about the marketing that gets in the way of good stories so much because things have to fit tidily into these little buckets. I know we need to know how to find things in the bookstore or whatever, so we need genre designations, but I feel like so many great stories just fall through the cracks because of that rigidity that we have built.
I totally agree, and I think there's also the added stigma of certain genres being quote-unquote dead. Like, right, the Western, people talk about how the Western is a dead genre. And I mean, publishers would tell me, like, we love this, but we don't know how to sell a Western. And my response, my gut response was, because you don't sell Westerns. Like,
exactly.
Like, that's why you don't know how, because you don't try to. And I know I have friends who've written, written books that are kind of, they fall in between the cracks of genres, and they meet the same resistance. And I mean, I understand that it's a business, but it still can be very frustrating when you read a friend's book and you're like, this is fantastic. And then they can't sell it, and it never sees the light of day because it's too much one thing, not enough of the other.
Right. Right. You tackle some pretty big themes in this book, and they kind of but like the magic system, it's very subtle and really is born out of the characters and their interactions and their relationships more than you just like beating us over the head, about, this is a story about people that are different and how we treat people that are different and, assumptions that are made by people and things like that. And it doesn't feel that way at all. It feels like that we're experiencing this, what it's like to be an outcast and what it's like to lose everyone in your life and how you deal with grief and how you deal with separation. This is a post-Civil War story, and we're even dealing with themes of, of what that war was fought about and how we see each other in that climate. I mean, there's some, right, some big stuff going on in this book. But it is all dealt with and born out of the characters and their interactions. So were those things you were even thinking about as you're writing, or these just come out of where the story is and who it's with? And so these things just kind of bubble out.
A little bit of both. I definitely planned some themes just by virtue of how the character is and what their motivations are and their goals are. And then sometimes, you get surprised. Characters will have conversations and they'll say something profound and you're like, oh, that's what this scene is about. You kind of just wander into the scene hoping that something interesting happens and you get something that surprises you. There's a scene in Make Me No Grave, without giving too many spoilers, of some Native Americans who are seeking refuge in a church. And everything about that scene is kind of contradictory to what you would imagine it, how it goes down, who the quote unquote bad guys are in the scene, that sort of thing. And I don't like the simplistic black and white view of the West with like, oh, these people were bad and these people were good. I think, it's definitely, there's so much ambiguity, moral ambiguity, excuse me, in sure, in the West. And I try to portray that with, I think especially people have complicated relationships with the past, both the historical past and their personal past. And I think that I hope that comes across in the book.
Yeah, definitely. So the question on everyone's mind that has read the book is, will there be more stories from Apostle, from this place? Is there more coming?
Yes. I am currently working on the sequel, tentatively titled Render Up the Ghost, and it will take place after Make Me No Grave. Hopefully, I hope to have it done by next year. And the story is going to be a little bit weirder than the first book. I kind of envision the series, if I can continue to write books for it, as diving more and more into the weirder elements of this Western world, this kind of alternate history sort of
Right.
setting. The second one will also be from Apostle's point of view.
Nice. Nice.
I
Well, you've
just
done
love him
such a
so much.
I know. And another question I was thinking about earlier was how does it feel as someone who established herself as a science fiction writer and a pretty hardcore science fiction writer from the first series that you wrote? You're just, spot on with the with science fiction tropes, and there's really no ambiguity as to what that story is. To now being someone who is getting all this attention as a Western writer and as a weird Western writer. That the other side of that whole genre discussion we had is that a lot of times people want authors to stick to one thing and be, if you're a science fiction writer, you need to stay there because your fans are not going to follow you, from one thing to another. And I think that's just utter bull. I think if you tell stories that people like and people like you, they'll follow you, to write cookbooks. I don't care, but how do you feel about that now? Establishing yourself over here, and now you're over here. And if an idea comes tomorrow for a wizards and warlock story, will you feel free to write that kind of story?
So I don't want to write the same book over and over and over again. I don't begrudge anyone who likes to read that kind of story. I don't, that's totally fine. That's just not the kind of author that I feel that I am. I want to explore different stories and different genres, and I was initially terrified about coming out with this book. I just thought, oh, this is going to make all of my sci-fi fans really annoyed. They're going to be like, what is this? This is totally different. And I just kind of hoped that my past fans would like it and that hopefully I'd gain new fans who maybe go and investigate my old work and find that they like that as well. But I will say that I've recently gotten into true crime and just reading and listening to audiobooks about it, and it's moving me towards wanting to write a thriller, which I have no experience at all whatsoever. But I, darn it, if I didn't come up with an opening line recently, then I'm like, oh man, this is a novel.
Oh, I am the world's worst at writing opening lines and opening chapters because I'll be like, I'll get an idea of, oh man, this, and it, you could start this amazing premise and then like, well, that's one more thing I'm gonna have to write one day. Let me file that away.
Exactly. You're like, why am I doing this to myself? I'm just adding more work, but
I know, but if you don't grab those things when they fly past your brain, and I think some of those things are so fleeting. If you don't grab a hold of it when you have the chance, one day it'll mean something.
oh, exactly. Yeah, and if you I keep like paper and journals and stuff everywhere where I live so that, if an idea comes, if a line comes, I can write it down because I know that I will forget it. Like, it's gone. Same for like if I'm laying in bed at night, like I'll reach over and write in the dark, and in the morning I'll be like, what did I write? But at least I've gotten something down.
Well, and those stories, no matter what genre it is always going to have your heart in it. And I think that's what readers need to keep in mind, that trust the author, that this story is coming from the same place the others came from. It just may look a little different.
Yeah, exactly. And I think as a reader, I love it when authors try new things, and I'm totally down to follow them into whatever genre they go into, just because, you know, life is short. I want to experience as much as I possibly can. And right. part of that is, you know, living normally, but also reading all sorts of things. And weirdly enough, I find these days what I love to read always catches me by surprise. I'll pick up a book that I'm like, oh, I'm going to love this book, and it'll leave me cold, or I'll just lose interest. And then I'll pick up a book that someone recommended to me, or that just looked a little interesting, not usually my normal fare, and I'll fall in love with it and just be totally blown away.
Haley, I absolutely love the new book. I love everything that you're doing. If people are just discovering you and your work, is there a place they can find you online to dig into more of what you're doing?
Yeah, so readers can go to hnstoneauthor.com, and on there I have links to my novels, to my short stories, and my poetry. Most of my poetry is available to read online for free. You can just follow those links. Same for the short fiction. And there is also the first three chapters of Make Me No Grave are available to read for free on my website. So if you go there, you can check it out. I'm also on Twitter at Haley, H-A-Y-L-E-Y _Stone. So you can find me on there. And I love talking to fellow readers and writers. So don't be afraid to at me.
Awesome. Haley, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show. We're putting links to all the stuff you do in the show notes. Ernie Howard has a new book up for pre-order. It's called Melody 8. My mother used to sing to me when I was scared at night. She would lay beside me and I would place my head on her chest, hearing the song through the vibration of her body. I loved my mother's voice right up to the day she was put to death because of it. If you're a lover of post-apocalyptic stories, you need to get ready for a new twist on the genre. We must change the vibration, or the frequency will forever change us. Melody 8. Pre-order it now from Ernie Howard. Soulbreaker by Clara Coulson is free right now. There's a dangerous monster loose on the streets of Aurora, Michigan, and Detective Cal Kinsey is determined to stop it, or die trying. 2 years ago, Cal Kinsey was an up-and-coming cop in the Aurora Police Department, but during a fateful nighttime stakeout in search of a prolific killer, Cal witnessed the darkest corner of his dreams come to life. A rogue vampire slaughtered his partner and introduced Cal to the supernatural world he never knew existed in the shadows. Soulbreaker is free now from Clara Coulson. There's a link to it in the show notes. Also by August Ansel, After the Pretty Pox, The Attic. A searing act of bioterrorism, a catastrophic plague they call the Pretty Pox. Most of the human race is dead, and for 2 years, Ari McInnes has been alone, writing out the aftermath of the disease. Hidden in the attic of her ruined home, Ari survives by wit and skill, ritual and habit. Convinced that humans are little more than a dangerous fluke of nature, she chooses solitude, even in matters of life and death. Ari's precarious world is upended when her youngest brother, a man she's never met, appears out of nowhere with a badly injured woman. Their presence in the attic draws the attention of a dark watcher in the woods, and Ari is soon forced to choose between the narrow ideas that have sustained her and a stubborn instinct to love and protect. In book one of August Ansel's captivating post-apocalyptic series, After the Pretty Pox, cast an unwavering eye on what it means to be human in a world where nature has the upper hand, and the only rules left to live by, for good or ill, are the ones written on our hearts. After the Pretty Pox, The Attic. There's a link to it in the show notes. Now on to our show. Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. You can find archives of all of the shows at hankgarner.com, and when you're there, please subscribe. Up next is an audiobook clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
The Satanic Temple of Salem, Massachusetts was not what Joey expected. On the drive over, he'd sat nervously in the back seat of Jezebel's old convertible, knees bobbing, mind racing, imagining a Mordor black fortress of the damned, with parapets of skulls and tall Gothic towers, lair of the Lord of the Flies, with lava and sulfur and the heads of orcs on pikes. But it was just a house, a gingerbread Victorian on Scary Street, with white columns and a generous veranda. He could imagine Auntie Em living inside. Rook turned in his seat. You okay? Sure. It's not so spooky. Jezebel parked, turned around, and whispered, It used to be a funeral home. Oh. Joey looked at the house again, and now Auntie Em was embalming people in the basement. Jezebel climbed out. Rook cracked his door but whispered, Hey, if it makes you feel better, this is my first time too. He winked. Come on. Jezebel had hurried ahead, waving to someone. Joey and Rook crunched up the gravel drive, their steps slowing as the house grew larger. Scarlet floodlights bloodied the wide veranda. Figures in black stood there, whispering to each other. Joey thought for a moment that one of them was an actual horned devil, but it was just a kid with a pointed hipster beard and horn-rimmed glasses pushed onto his forehead. They climbed the stairs. Two guys in black leather filled the front doorway, intimidating, and Joey cringed as he passed between them. The place did have that funeral home feel. The hallways were deep and shadowed. The Satanists had hung swoops of red velvet and pentagram wreaths of woven branches. Figures swirled past in the gloom. White lipsticked mouths and half-glimpsed tattoos, Celtic braids and shaved heads, leather skirts and bondage gear. Emaciated heroin pusher faces alongside grinning wannabes with dimples and baby fat. Joey passed a gilt mirror. He was wearing brand new and still store-creased, baby blue paisley and red, frankly just this side of pink, jeans. You should have told me to change. You look fine, said Rook. I feel like people are judging me for not being depraved enough. Well, they are. Rook and Joey ventured deeper into the bowels of Satan's fan club headquarters. The temple had an actual gift shop in the back, the Bad Seed, with varsity jerseys numbered 666 and the satanic verses in paperback, 30% off. On the wall hung a framed page of wide-ruled notepaper. My teachers told me I had to write to somebody I admire, so I'm writing to the Satanic Temple. Please burn my teacher in the flames of hell. Hail Satan. Johnny Fierro, age 8. Look here, whispered Rook, grinning over two tall and formidable drums. He tapped out a rhythm and sang softly. Babaloo. Oh my God, said Joey. It's I Love Lucifer. They fell into hushed hysterics, earning a decisive ahem from the Bad Seed's cashier, who was not amused.